campaigns, or at least ones, some of the ones we have examples of, they had a selective service system. We note that Deuteronomy 20 specifies certain groups of people that were exempt from going to warfare. If you had built a house, but had not actually lived in, dedicated the house, if you'd planted a vineyard and had harvested, you'd betrothed yourself to a mate and you had never married, or if you were fearful and faint-hearted, you were to be exempt. Levites were to be exempt as being those that were committed to godly pursuits. So these are some of the ones that were exempt. So the principle here is that family had priority even over welfare or warfare. And the continuity of life is more important than fighting war. And so it was considered to be the world's worst fate to begin something and not to taste of the fruit of it. To begin a marriage and never actually consummate the marriage. Begin a house and never actually get to live in the house. So these people were exempt from warfare. I suspect when they were getting ready to go to war, they went out and started building houses. I don't know. Just kidding. Anyway. Thank you, Alan. I pay him for that. I'll lower his pay, but it was pretty penny left. Another law that's interesting, this is one that is really interesting, in Deuteronomy 23, 9 through 14, are actually laws here pertaining to the sanitation of the camp when they're out on the camp, when they're out on the campaign. And stop and think about it. No sewage system. Maybe we better turn and read this. Deuteronomy 23, it's unbelievable just because you probably didn't know this was in the Bible. Deuteronomy 23, beginning with verse number 9. When you go out as an army against your enemies, you shall keep yourself from every evil thing. If there is among you any man who is unclean because of a nocturnal emission, he must go outside the camp. He may not re-enter the camp. Same rule that we've seen applying in the regular camp. But it shall be, as evening approaches, he shall bathe himself with water, and at sundown he may re-enter the camp. You shall also have a place outside the camp and go out there, and you shall have a spade among your tools. And it shall be when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and shall turn to cover over your excrement. Since the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and defeat your enemies before you, therefore your camp must be holy, and he must not see anything indecent among you, lest he turn away from you. So even here in the military camp. What's your problem?
It sounds like God's coming to Stefan or something.
Well, that's exactly what it's saying.
That's the first quarter job.
I knew you wouldn't believe it.
First quarter job.
What? I'm missing it.
First quarter job.
First quarter job. Well, it wasn't even a quarter job. I remember one time talking to some Herbert Armstrong people who, you know, believe that Christians still have to follow the entire law of Moses. And so they were in my office seeing his wife one day, and they were going on and on about how we were keeping the law of Moses. And I said, "Where's your shovel?" He said, "What?" I said, "Where's your shovel?" He said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, the law says you're supposed to have a shovel, cover the dirt over when you have to do your business." I said, You're going to follow the law now. You got to go all the way and carry your shovel around with you. That really got him. Well, it doesn't apply. Well, but the point is here that the camp was to be kept clean. That's the point. Do you see that? All through the law, how God stresses cleanliness. Cleanliness of the person. Cleanliness of the dwelling place where you live. Cleanliness even of a military camp. For goodness sake. Right there. God insists on cleanliness. And it's like Ms. Harris says. It sounds like he doesn't want to step in it as he walks around the camp. And that is the picture that is being conveyed. The camp is to be kept clean. I thought you didn't know that was in the scripture. Now, turn over to page number 95 and notice that during war, They oftentimes blew trumpets, and you might think, well, those would be signals for the different units of the army, and they may have been, but the trumpets also had a religious significance. The trumpets were calling on God, so to speak, to take matters into his hands, and to more or less put the battle under the control of the Lord. In terms of prisoners, if the prisoners happened to be of these seven Canaanite nations, they were to be exterminated as God's judgment upon the Canaanites. However, in other campaigns, the men and the married women were executed. The single women were kept to be servant girls in the camp of Israel. Many of them later, of course, converted and became part of the Israelite nation. You could marry a woman that was taken in war, but if you did so, you could not treat her like a slave. If you married her, you treated her like a wife. Now, that's a very important passage there, because it nails down the point that a wife is not a slave. There's a clear differentiation between slave and a wife. If you took her as a slave, she'd be a slave. But if you married her as a wife, she's a wife. Be treated as a wife. If you decided you wanted to sell her to someone else later on, you couldn't do it. She was your wife. And there's a difference, you see. The Bible makes that very clear here. This is another one of these passages that deal with the treatment of women under the law, which is a subject that has not been given, I think, a fair investigation recently. Now, Mr. McCrickard, you and Don are going to have to cool it, or we'll have to separate you.
No, I was just laughing.
Well, but I've been watching for 2 hours. I've been trying my best to restrain myself from embarrassing you. But there are limits to my ability to restrain myself. So I reached the limit right there. It was the straw that broke the camel. Now, the principle involved here in regard to prisoners was that warfare was to punish and or destroy evil and to overthrow an evil order in society. The spoils of war, interesting the way they divided up the spoils of war. 50% went to the fellows who fought in the army and 50% to the congregation. Out of that amount, the warriors were to contribute 0.25% to the Lord as a tax, so to speak, or God's part. The congregation was to contribute from their part 2% to the work of the Lord and for his appreciation for God's watch care over them during battle. It's interesting to see that in the warfare of that day, they prohibited the scorched earth policy. They weren't to go around cutting down fruit trees and vineyards. You see, war was designed to punish evil people, not to punish the land. Other involvements of the sixth commandment, of course, a child sacrifice is prohibited. We've talked about that. But another aspect of the sixth commandment is that men were to pursue peace, or shalom is the Hebrew word, used 250 times in the Old Testament. Shalom refers to wholeness, to total well-being, to health, to soundness. The opposite of thou shalt not kill is thou shalt seek peace. You shall seek people's well-being and their wholeness. And so Christians are people, it seems to me, that ought to be committed to those enterprises that are designed to build people up, to protect life, to make life more meaningful for people. Peace, ultimately, is a gift of God. And peace does not begin to happen in someone's life until they have established, through Christ, peace with God. This introduces the requirement of love. If we are to love our neighbors as ourselves, Jesus said that's one of the main requirements of the law of Moses. It summarizes the Ten Commandments, thou shalt love your neighbor as yourself. And when you love someone, you obviously don't go around murdering them. And you do the opposite. You go around seeking their good. Even when you have to rebuke a neighbor, you do so in such a way as to not incur sin. Okay, so I want you to see also Leviticus 19:18, which I think speaks to us. Read for me, Missy. Marty?
Okay.
somebody who was listening.
You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of the people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself, thy neighbor.
Ah. Did you get that? You shall not take vengeance against your neighbor or bear a grudge. This is an important principle here. And obviously related to the sixth commandment. It's the opposite of the sixth commandment. You're to treat your neighbors with respect, to treat them as you would treat yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, a lot of people think Jesus was the first one who ever said that. And here it is, way back in the law of Moses. You love your neighbor as yourself, you're not going to do any harm to them. Your neighbor here, of course, is any person who is a fellow believer, certainly a fellow believer, anyone. Jesus answered that question about who is my neighbor by saying your neighbor is whoever you're in contact with, whoever happens to need you at a given time. There's another provision related to the sixth commandment that I think is of importance, and that's Leviticus 13 through 15 that introduces the principle of quarantine in the light of the AIDS problem. This is relevant, I think, to really discuss the issue of quarantine. As far as the biblical principles are concerned, the right of society is greater than the right of the individual. And if any individual has a contagious disease, he was compelled by God's law to remain outside the camp until the symptoms of that contagious disease had disappeared, until he was cured, in other words, and not to be part of society until that happened. Now, I can remember in my childhood that quarantine was used quite readily as a means of protecting society from those who were contaminated with a contagious disease. Maybe some of you aren't old enough to remember that, but we used to quarantine people for polio. Polio epidemics would come out, people would be quarantined. Rheumatic fever, quarantine. You'd find big signs on houses. No one allowed to enter, no one allowed to leave this house because it's rheumatic fever. It was quarantine. And it used to be society was very protective of itself. Nowadays, it seems like we've been over so far to protect the rights of individuals that we forget that society as a whole has some rights too. And so we take people with contagious diseases and we put them into high density situations and allow them to attend public institutions where they're in contact with others and could very easily spread the disease. And it just seems like we've forgotten that the society has some rights too, and the biblical law makes that very clear that there is a legitimate quarantine that should take place when contagious diseases are in evidence. Okay, that's all I want to say about the sixth commandment. Let's go over to the seventh commandment, the sanctity of marriage. And let's start out by distinguishing between adultery and fornication, because sometimes those words are used interchangeably and we want to try to use them accurately. Technically speaking, adultery is the violation of the wife of some woman. And the penalty for adultery was both parties could be executed, if it depending on the seriousness and the frequency and all this kind of thing. Both parties could be executed. Death was the ultimate penalty, not the inevitable penalty. They even had, and we'll talk about this in more detail later, even suspicion of adultery was a serious matter. And they had a whole trial that they would go through under the of a wife that was suspected of having committed adultery. We'll talk more about that. Fornication, on the other hand, is unchastity with an unmarried woman. And we'll have some more to say about that as we move on through our lesson two. Let's make sure we understand that adultery, as the Bible treats it, is a moral issue. It's not a question of violating somebody else's property rights. But the Bible treats adultery as a moral issue, and I give you the references on that. To put the seventh commandment in proper perspective, I think we need to go back and to look just briefly at the original marriage in Genesis. There we see an equal union of people who are equal in personhood, both the man and the woman are made in the image of God. She is to be a help suitable to him, and we talked about that word help as a word that's also used of God. She was made of one of his ribs, another way of saying she has equality with him. The wife in the scriptures was never regarded as a mere possession, as some people have charged. I don't see that at all. The husband and the wife are equal not only in personhood, but equal in responsibility in the home. They both are charged with the responsibility of training up the children. But we do see in the original marriage that when the marriage takes place, the woman, by virtue of the marriage, agrees to accept the headship of the man. And if she's not willing to do that, then she might as well not get married, because biblical marriage involves that recognition of leadership in the home. The picture of the ideal wife and mother in Proverbs 31, however, does not picture someone sitting at home and cooking meals and cleaning house all day. Pictures a very wise, intelligent person, a woman who is a good homemaker, a good mother, but a good businesswoman as well. And so the women of the Bible days were not just stuck at home and isolated there. They were quite active in the affairs of the community and in supporting the family and in other kinds of ways that are depicted there in Proverbs 31. That first marriage not only was an equal union, it was a joyous union, as we can see very clearly in Genesis chapter 2. And it was a divinely sanctioned union. Marriage was sanctioned there in the garden as God brought Eve to Adam. God gave away the bride, so to speak. The father, who was Eve's father and creator, gave her away to Adam as the bride. A good wife is from the Lord, we're told in Proverbs. To find a good wife is to find favor with the Lord, we're told again in Proverbs. A good wife is a husband's pride and joy. The reverse of that is also true. A fellow marries the wrong girl, then it says the wife will be like rottenness in his bones. Now, the same thing, of course, since Proverbs is written as a father's advice to his son, it always indicates this in reference to wives. When you reverse the whole process and say the same thing is also true of husbands. Girls that marry the wrong one will certainly find out their husband's like rottenness in the bones very quickly. Now, that first marriage was an intimate union. A man shall leave his father and mother. And that indicates that a new home is being set up, and the man truly reaches adulthood when he marries and sets out on his own to establish a new home unit. A man shall cleave to his wife. Relationship here is to be one of interpersonal fidelity to one another. That's involved in that first marriage, fidelity to one another. Adam knew his wife. Word know, of course, in the Bible indicating the intimacy of the sexual union, because that's the closest knowledge that two people on this earth can have of one another. The couple, or the biblical couple in an ideal marriage, are devoted to each other. We see the picture of that many times in the scripture. That first marriage as God intended it, was to be a purposeful union. It was to meet the need that man and woman have for companionship. That's one of the purposes. It was to multiply the human race, another purpose. It was to carry out the responsibility to subdue and control the earth. The husband and the wife together are to accomplish that and to do that, and to cultivate a godly seed. Malachi chapter 2 is one of the strongest passages in the Bible on marriage. And it explains to us that God created only one wife for Adam. He could have created many, but he created only one. And why one? Why one, Malachi says? Because he wanted to produce a godly seed. In other words, the ideal family is one man, one woman, raising godly children. That is the picture. That's the ideal of the Bible. Now let's talk about the mechanics of marriage. The marriage contract, which there always appeared to be a marriage contract, was arranged by the girl's father. Now, when you guys were in the Holy Land traveling through, how many of you went to the Holy Land this year? And you're traveling through Jordan, did you happen to notice any little houses with white flags flying?
And through the desert.
Did they explain to you what the white flags were? Means there's an available female in this house, and let's negotiate. Yes, they have little white flags they fly when there's a girl of marriageable age, so that all the fellows who are of marriageable age and still looking can come by and check things out there, and they can work out the contract there for the marriage. I've been there several times. There's one place I've seen the same flag flying every time I've been there. I don't know whether he had a whole string of daughters or one that he couldn't marry, but anyway. Okay, so the marriage contract then. In the process of the marriage arrangements, a dowry was paid, a mohar was paid from the groom to the parents of the bride. Now, this has been wrongly interpreted by Westerners as purchasing a wife. And I don't think it was looked upon that way at all. But rather, it was a protection for the wife in case the husband should prove to be unworthy, unfaithful, or desert her in some way. He already has put up a deposit, so to speak, which he loses. And which money would then be used to support the wife in case the husband bailed out on him. It isn't a bad idea. Suppose husbands-to-be today were required to put in an escrow account, which they could not touch, say $10,000, and that would be the equivalent of what they have to pay in this mohar over there. They don't pay it in dollars, but they pay it in what's equivalent to them in their economy. Suppose a fellow had to put $10,000 up in escrow, which if he were unfaithful to his wife, or he deserted his wife, or he mistreated his wife, that money was hers to claim in the courts. And it was under the control of her family. So his family didn't have any say about it. If they perceived that the daughter was being mistreated, she could claim the money. Now that's what the mohar was all about. So it constituted a protection for the women who were far, and still are, far more dependent on their husbands in that society than they would be in our society today, and in our Western society. It also constituted an inheritance. Let's suppose the marriage worked out like it was supposed to. It was a happy situation. The mohar would then constitute an inheritance for the children of the marriage. Not a bad idea. No true marriage could take place without this mohar or this dowry. If a wife... If the wife did not have the dowry, she could only become like a concubine. She could not be a full wife unless these goods were swapped. The bride paid a dowry, had a dowry that was taken over by the husband at marriage, and the husband had to put up the mohar to the family of the bride. So there's really it's not purchasing either way. There's some earnest money that's put up on both sides. If the bride couldn't afford the dowry for her part, then she becomes a concubine, a secondary wife. That's the difference in the Bible times between a wife and a concubine. A wife could afford the dowry, the concubine could not. So the father of the bride would be able to know that the young man who's going to marry his daughter actually was financially responsible. If he can come up with that kind of money prior to the marriage, chances are he's going to be a responsible provider for his daughter. And I guess that's what most fathers worry about most about their daughters. Well, this law of the marriage contract, the mohar, protected the daughter from being a concubine or a slave. So that's the purpose of it. Page 99, in cases of seduction and rape, that was a problem back then, even as it is today. It's a tragic thing when it happens. But it was not automatic. Let's say, let's read it for ourselves. Let's go to Exodus 22, 16 and 17. Now let's see how this was handled. I think we can gain some insights onto perhaps how this problem should be handled today. If a man seduces a virgin, now notice, it never talks about a virgin seducing a man. The responsibility for any sexual misconduct outside of marriage is laid completely in the lap of the man. He holds the responsibility. And I think in our society, we've sort of switched that, haven't we? And the guy gets off scot-free, and the girl pays the consequences in both reputation and in possibly the child that comes along. Isn't that true? Am I wrong about that? And whoever hears about the guy, he goes right on with his career, goes to medical school, or becomes a lawyer, or wherever, and the girl stays home, raises a baby that she's perhaps not psychologically or materialistically able to provide for. But if a man seduces a virgin, he's responsible, who is not engaged, okay, now that's probably the most common that we would see today, and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her, there's that mohar, to be his wife. He's got to put up the same amount of money that he would put up if he were going to marry her. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. Now, in other words, who makes the determination as to whether a marriage will take place? The money had to be put up, substantial. A substantial fine had to be put up, the same as if he were going to marry her, but he didn't automatically marry the girl. I've heard some today say, when you have sexual relations in God's sight, you're already married. Biblically, is that true? It is not true. I don't know who ever started that. I know there's some youth ministers around the state that are teaching that concept. And it's absolutely not true. See it for yourself. Here a sexual act has taken place. Are they married? No. Who decides if they're going to get married? Whose father?
Her
father. And what would be the grounds, you think, that her father, assuming he's a responsible father, what's going to be his basis for determining whether he's going to permit the marriage to go on? Well, a lot of things. You're exactly right. One of them being the feelings of his daughter and the likelihood of the marriage having a prospect of succeeding. But in either case, the guy has to pay the dowry. There's a penalty, you see, for irresponsible sexual conduct prior to marriage. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. That's the way God says that situation ought to be handled. And there will be a time that you'll be thankful that you heard these. And I hope you'll remember, because just very recently we had this very situation in our church, and the father of the girl came in, and somehow he'd even gotten it in his head that a child born in that kind of a situation did not have a soul. And he was all distraught. I mean, it wasn't prejudice or anything. He'd been taught that. He really believed that. And we had to spend an hour and a half, 2 hours going through the scriptures, you know, about these kinds of things. And I pointed out to him, I said, you're the one biblically who makes the decision. I said, under biblical law, the boy who was guilty didn't have any choice. Okay? Now, if the marriage followed, when you read all the passages, if the marriage actually did follow, then the boy lost any right of divorce. He could not divorce this girl under any circumstances. All right, now let's see the penalty here. The guy pays the mohar regardless of what the father says. If the marriage takes place, which is determined by the girl's father, no possible divorce. That's it. They are stuck together for forever under God's law. And those are some strict rules there. Now, the religious ceremony. Was there one? The law does not require a religious consecration of marriage. That is some kind of a formal religious service. But does this mean that they did not have some kind of a formal marriage type service? I don't think so. Malachi 2:14 regards marriage as a divinely sanctioned bond. Did they just commence living together? You have some stuff on this?
Yes.
Good. Share with us.
Okay. We're talking about Malachi 2:14.
Yeah.
And it's regarding marriage. And the purpose of the Hebrew marriage was to ensure godly offspring. But the Jewish older men were divorcing their wives and marrying strangers. And that was just
so your job was to research Malachi 2:14, see what light it shows on there. Did anybody else do Malachi 2:14? All right, Marty.
I basically
don't. Okay. We wasted 30 seconds to find that out, huh?
Oh,
you forgot what you wrote. Let's turn to Malachi. I don't know that you girls have done justice to Malachi 2:14. Let's turn over to it. That is a tremendous passage. So I'm going to take time to go into it just a second. Okay, you're right about the situation. Did all of you pick up on the situation that these men were divorcing their Jewish wives and marrying these younger women? And then he says in 2:14, yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth. That's the key phrase. The Lord has been witness. Now, we say in the marriage ceremony, we are gathered together in the company of the presence of God and the company of these witnesses or something such thing as that. This verse, as far as I know, is the only verse in the scripture that suggests that God is a witness at a marriage. He is a witness. He witnesses the bond that is drawn there between the man and his wife. Against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion. That word, girls, if you'd done a little more research, you would have found some interesting things on that word, which is literally business partner. She's your equal in the marriage. And your wife by covenant. That's what I was looking for. Covenant is an agreement between two parties. Okay? And that's what marriage involved. You have something, Donna?
The covenant, if it was broken, it was like they were breaking the covenant with God and besides the marriage when they broke this covenant.
Okay. Good. It's a three-party covenant, right? Between the two people, but they do it in the name of God. So if they break their covenant with one another, it's an offense against God. Okay. Yes, Martin. Now you're getting back in the ball game back there. Between the parents.
Since it was the wife of your youth, they thought it was arranged marriage.
In either case, it's still a covenant made in the name of God. Right? Yeah. But it's still a covenant. Marriage is a covenant. This is something we don't emphasize enough. Most people don't understand what a covenant is and how solemn a covenant is. Relationship is, she is your wife by covenant. A covenant has been hammered out. And don't think that because the covenant was hammered out between the two families that the two individuals involved had no say in it. The families, the fathers of the two families were acting sort of as agents for their children. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, no father of a decent father, now I'm sure there must have been exceptions, but no decent father is going to marry his daughter off to some guy she can't stand, doesn't want to marry, and vice versa. So the parents here, if a covenant is worked out, it was done as agents of the couple involved. Don't you think that makes good sense, Marty? Just turn it over and let your parents work out the details.
Don't bother me with it.
No, don't bother you with it. Okay. All right. Okay. Now let's talk about. So what about this business then? When were they actually married? Well, I think that there was some formal covenant, and covenants were always instituted with some sort of a ceremony. Now, marriage ceremonies differ from culture to culture, but you know there are really three basic ingredients in marriage. Number one is the giving of the bride by the bride's father. Number two, the receiving of the bride by the groom. And number three, the willingness of the bride to accept the groom as her husband. Those three basic ingredients are present in every marriage. Without those three ingredients, you don't have a marriage. Okay, so there must have been some formal act at which this covenant was ratified, you see? Some ceremony, some action that made this covenant a real thing. It just didn't start. I've heard people say this. In fact, I was brought up to believe this way. That when two people just start living together, in God's eyes, they're already married. But the Bible doesn't say that at all. It's not true. There was a time of the entering into the covenant, and then from that point, they were married. Now, what about a purity prior to marriage? It was a big deal. And a fellow who accused his wife of being impure at the time of the marriage could get himself a heap of trouble with the law. And, yes?
In Deuteronomy 22, it had different cases of, different situations that could come about. And if a guy accused his wife of not being a virgin and her parents came before the judge and proved that she was a virgin, then the man had to pay 100 shekels of silver to his father-in-law.
That's twice as much as you'd have to pay to marry her in the first place. terrific fine.
And he couldn't divorce her as long.
Now, what's the principle there? That a husband is not permitted under God's law to slander his wife. Now, if he entered into marriage knowing, see, this would all be brought out at the time of the marriage. Let's suppose that there had been some indiscretion on her part, and she wasn't a virgin at the time of marriage. That would all be part of the formal negotiations, and all would be up front documented at the beginning. Now, if he knew what he was, in other words, if he thought he was marrying a virgin, and it turned out that she wasn't a virgin, then he's been deceived. There's been some fraud involved.
She'd be stoned to death.
She would be stoned to death, that's true. But that would be such a hard, rare situation, because what's that trying to say? That's trying to tell, look, parents, be upfront about this thing. Don't use deception in marriage. Let both parties know what they're
it would,
getting.
It would be at her father's door too.
Because she has offended. Why is she stoned? What's the seriousness of her crime? She committed folly while she lived in her father's house. Did you get that? That's Deuteronomy 22. The young lady who is promiscuous, we would call it today, is really violating which commandment? Not just the one about adultery, but what other commandment? Honor thy father and thy mother. Because the promiscuity of the daughter in the house of her father brought dishonor to the father. Therefore, she was to be stoned to death if, in fact, she was proven to be unfaithful at the time of marriage, stoned to death at the door of her father. Yeah.
I don't know if this question is the right time to answer, but it was...
Oh, go ahead.
He got the more penalty than the other one in extra.
What did you find?
It was hard. I found kind of rough. I mean, one kind of...
Tell us about
it. It says, know the severe punishment that was to be given to a husband who dared to bring a false accusation against his wife. And it was kind of more against the guy. And the other one says it was the parents who represented the girl in cases of disputes with the man. If the man was found guilty, he was chastised and immersed or fined 100 shekels of silver. And this one says it was more on the girls. A man is entitled not only to look for a wife of a certain character or qualification, but to return her to her father if she does not answer to his expectations, accompanied by a demand for the restoration of all this other stuff. If she was proven guilty, she would suffer the penalty of death. So this one kind of was more against.
Okay. So kind of equal penalty. But isn't that even contrary to what is commonly understood, that the women got all the bad deal and the men didn't have any responsibility? Lord, what'd you find?
Mine's a little different way. It's that the woman, well, I also found a lot of the same things she found, and a lot of things were equal. But in one area, the woman's penalty was greater, and that is if a woman who was married had sex with another man, both would be put to death. But if a man who was married had sex with another woman, the man would just have to pay a penalty. It wasn't as greater an offense. Because if a woman who was married had sex and there could be a chance that she would have a child, and that child would be introduced into a family line that he would be of legitimate children, illegitimate child, so her consequences would be much greater if she did it in marriage than if he did it. So the penalty really was greater for a woman.
Okay, but what are the scriptures? I mean, you're giving opinions of commentators, but Now stop and think about what you said. Now wait, let's stop and analyze.
It was over the Deuteronomy scripture.
Well, let's look at it now. Okay. If a guy commits, man commits adultery with another woman, they both are stoned, right? Or at least that's the death penalty is liable for both of them, right? Now you're saying that if a man who was married committed fornication with some woman who wasn't married?
Right.
Who wasn't married?
Right. Then he would, then...
Then he's not stoned?
It said, it wasn't a crime of a high nature. It wasn't as, he was could be a married man who lied single, lay in a lie, I can say, but the single woman, it was not as big of an offense because of the married woman, she did it and had a child.
Okay, that's true. I think the situation is very rare because the man, he would fall under this law about the having to marry the girl. But what if he's already...
It was a married man, it said a married man.
See, the law does not specifically address that particular issue. Really, that commentator is drawing a conclusion, but the law does not specifically address that particular situation of a married man and an unmarried woman. The law is envisioning the situation of two unmarried people or two married people. It just doesn't deal with the situation of a married and an unmarried.
And then another commentary said that all these were made, these penalties were to protect the woman. That's why the penalties were
okay.
Protection for women.
Interesting.
And engaged woman was also considered unmarried.
Same rules as in married, right? She already belonged to the fellow. Sometimes those engagements would go on for years. Before the marriage actually took place. Sorry to tell you about that, girls. Okay, what about polygamy? Let's talk about polygamy. We know that marriage was originally instituted monogamous there in the garden. There was only one man and one woman. And polygamy entered in through the line of Cain, his descendant. Lamech was the first person to have two wives. Lamech, not the famous Lamech of Noah's father, but the other Lamech in the line of Cain. He had two wives, Ada and Zillah. And then when you get to Genesis chapter 6, apparently polygamy becomes a real problem. In the patriarchal age, Abram had relations with Hagar while he was married to Sarah, which was considered to be a concubine. Esau had three wives. Jacob married two sisters and two concubines. So that's about the extent, really, of polygamy in the Old Testament. Dwight found 13 cases of polygamy. That's all. We sometimes think everybody in the Bible had more than one wife, but this fellow named Dwight did the research on it. He finds only 13 cases, 12 of them by persons of absolute power, that is, people that no one could challenge and punish, you see. Actually, polygamy is not that well documented in the scriptures. Monogamy was by far the standard. Now, there is some implied censure for polygamy in the Old Testament. The flood came about partly in punishment for polygamy. See Genesis 6, 1 through 7. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair and married whomsoever they chose. That implies polygamy. Yes.
13,
our book said there was 13 during the divided monarch and 6 before that. But if 9 kings are king and they're doing it, I mean,
wouldn't that be right to assume that
the
people
underneath
the king are doing it?
No, not necessarily. That's the whole point he's trying to make in the textbook. There's no evidence of that. I mean, you're making assumption, which not necessarily so. People in high-ranking positions, particularly kings, are notorious for doing things that others cannot do. I mean, the prime example is the leading news story of the weekend. Jimmy Swagger, who is the preacher. They show clips of him preaching against adultery and prostitution and fornication. Now it comes out he was doing it himself. You see, he was doing it, but the people who heard him preach weren't allowed to do it. You get the picture? Kings sometimes thought they had freedom that others did not have. I think it's a mistaken assumption to assume that because the kings did it, others under them did it. I just don't think polygamy was all that common in Old Testament times. Now, let's get back to our notes. Implied censure for polygamy. The flood, partly because of polygamy. And the law specifically said kings were not to multiply wives unto themselves. Many of them broke that. They were breaking the law. In the narratives, polygamy was always a cause of trouble between Sarah and Hagar, between Rachel and Leah, between Hannah and Peninnah. Solomon's wives caused him to get off the track with the Lord. Now, on the contrary, the Bible certainly endorses monogamy. Four passages built on the Genesis marriage decree forbid polygamy in the New Testament. But they're based upon the Genesis marriage decree. The wisdom books hold forth the model of monogamous marriage. You never find in Proverbs, even though Proverbs was written by Solomon, you never find in Proverbs any picture of a man with more than one wife. Isn't that interesting? And then also the prophets always depict monogamy as the ideal. So there's plenty of biblical support for monogamy as the ideal of marriage and God's intention for marriage. There are four passages in the scripture that allegedly support polygamy. Exodus chapter 21 verses 7 through 11 picture the selling of a daughter as a maid or a servant. This where you pay the dowry, you receive the mohar rather from someone for this daughter. Here's a picture. And you take a daughter into your family as a maid. The idea is maybe she's going to marry your son, and you pay the father of that girl the mohar, the amount of money that's due. Now, we need to take a look at these four passages, but our time is up for today. So we'll start here next week. Get started here with these four passages that supposedly endorse polygamy. So what am I running? About two lessons behind? Well,